and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the new film from the directors of Good Night Mommy, titled The Lodge. Stars Riley Keough as a, I guess you'd call her like a cult survivor.
Lone survivor of a doomsday cult.
Yeah, her father was the priest slash cult leader, sort of pseudo-Christian, and he and all the other members of the cult killed themselves, and she was left alive to spread the message of the faith or whatever. This isn't how the movie opens exactly. It's kind of dropped in, not like super slowly, but a little bit gradually in the early going.
Yeah, the marketing for this movie has been highly ambiguous, and I feel like that would have been maybe a better hook. Then, I mean, I was bound to see it anyway because I watch horror movies like my life depends on it. But that's a more novel sort of pitch than just another people going crazy together in a secluded cabin movie.
Right. It also stars Jaden Martell, plays the young Bill Denbro in the It movies.
Is he also the kid from Book of Henry?
Yes.
He looks more Henry-esque this time around with the like emo Peter Parker hair swept over his forehead.
Right. Yes. He is the title character from the Book of Henry. Ugh, let's not get into that.
I disagree, but it can wait until after the break.
And then in somewhat smaller roles, there's Richard Armitage, who plays the father of Jaden Martell's character and also his younger sister, played by an actress I'm not familiar with. And then Alicia Silverstone, who plays their mother. Riley Keough plays the sort of other woman in Richard Armitage's life.
The homewrecker.
The homewrecker, essentially. There's a lot of tensions, and he thinks it's a good idea for all of them to spend Christmas together in this secluded lodge like they used to do with their mom. Before I get any further into it, I guess we'll have Matt just kind of start more properly from the top.
Yeah, if you've seen any Cabin Fever horror movie, you have an idea of how this might play out, although this movie does have a few kind of neat tricks up its sleeve. So we open with the Hammer logo, actually. This is a Hammer horror production, which I did not know going in.
Me neither.
Also a Neon branded production, who also did Parasite. Props to them for sticking it to the president a couple days ago. So I was already in a good mood as soon as those two logos came up. I like the new Hammer logo a lot, actually. It's kind of like Marvel-us with all the faces in the letters.
Right.
So right away, I'm feeling good. And then in no time at all, I started feeling real, real bad because this movie's a stone-cold bummer from start to finish, but it doesn't waste any time. We open with a scene with the whole family, two kids and their parents. The mother arrives with the two kids at an apartment where the dad is living. There's a lot of friction. You get the sense that their marriage is dissolving. You don't really have a sense of whether that's happening amicably or not, and then it becomes very apparent that he's pushing for it and she's not ready to let go. He says, "We need to talk." He sends the kids to the gas station to get candy bars or something, and then they have an exchange in his kitchen where he talks about, "Oh, don't worry, she's not here. I just wanted to hash this out one-on-one. I want to finalize the divorce. Grace and I are getting married."
We do spot Grace, or at least someone who we figure is Grace, two separate times in this scene, kind of gives the lie to what Richard is saying.
Yes.
I refer to him as Richard because it's the actor's name, but it's also the character's name, so that's kind of convenient. Even though Richard claims that Grace is not there, when Laura is the mother's name, Laura and the two kids pull up to this residence, we see through some like upstairs windows the figure of a woman.
And you see the back of her head moving through the garden, and it's just quick glimpses. They allied Grace's face for kind of a really long time at the beginning of this movie.
Yes.
And you get a lot of like Grace Sasquatch sightings where she's off in the distance or she's, you know, glimpsed through a blurry pane of glass.
Yeah, she's just a silhouette.
If they dragged it out anymore, it was starting to smack a little of the mayor's secretary in Powerpuff Girls. You know how you like Miss Bellum, I think her name, the way you never see her face, you know, right. But there's, it's, anyway, we'll get to her grand reveal sooner rather than later. Alicia Silverstone, the mother, packs up the two kids, goes home, helps herself to a glass of wine, and then shoots herself in the head. Very jarringly. There's a lot of quiet bang in this movie. That's the first big bang.
Yeah.
You don't even know that she's packing heat. You know, it just comes from out of nowhere. And we're off.
So we have a funeral.
Yes, her daughter is distraught because she is very religious, it seems. We get the sense that the whole family is to varying degrees, but the daughter in particular is really...
Like the daughter and the mother, because we find out later that a lot of the religious, Christian specifically, iconography that's lying around the lodge belong to Laura.
Right. So the daughter is beside herself because she believes that her mother can't make it through the pearly gates, having killed herself. And these fears are confirmed in a way at the funeral when everyone releases black balloons into the sky. And the daughter has tied a doll that I think we're meant to understand is a stand-in for the mother to her balloon string. And the weight of the doll causes the balloon to just plummet down to the sidewalk.
Right.
In a way that is sort of darkly humorous, but also extremely sad.
Yeah. That night, the daughter is just wailing and refuses to be consoled. Daughter's name is Mia, incidentally. Jaden Martell's character is Aiden. Those are the two kids. Mia is just completely inconsolable and just repeatedly wailing to her father that their mother can't get into heaven. We jump 6 months later, and it's Thanksgiving time. We get the sense that in their family, they have a tradition of wearing turkey-shaped hats, but not eating turkey on Thanksgiving. It looks like they eat lasagna or something. Richard is trying to get them to make peace with Grace, who they already did not like even before their mother killed herself. Very, very hostile to her, even at the beginning of the movie, and now it's just kind of unthinkable that they even tolerate her. At that point, it's kind of impressive that he's managed to sustain any kind of relationship, given the fact that he is now the sole custodial parent, and he's presumably had to, like, sneak off to go see his girlfriend for 6 whole months, but I guess he's made it work.
Well, how their relationship has operated, we assume there was an affair. How they met sort of comes to light, but not entirely. What we come to learn that she was the subject of his work at one point. I guess he's...
like a true crime writer or something like that?
Yeah, and she, as we mentioned before the plot rundown, the lone survivor of a suicide cult, and the two kids start going down rabbit holes on his laptop, looking up case files and stuff like that. They find like a found footage Jonestown tape.
Yeah.
It turns into like a reject from one of the VHS movies or something for 2 minutes. It's Grace, the lone survivor, kind of documenting and chronicling everyone else drinking the Kool-Aid, so to speak.
Or having drunk the Kool-Aid. Yes. Really, she's just walking around a bunch of, like, shrouded corpses.
Yeah, and you hear bits of her father's last sermon.
Yeah. So it's on this basis that Aiden is screaming at his father like she's a fucking psychopath, even though it's not really fair. I mean, she was 12.
Sure.
You feel a lot of sympathy for Grace early on because even though, yes, these kids have been through a lot, they're also just impossibly fucking hostile.
Well, and if you've seen Goodnight Mommy, as we have, you know that that whole movie hinges on the is the mother out to get them or is this a bad seed movie question. And so that question hangs all over this movie as well. Probably would have even if I hadn't seen Goodnight Mommy, but that really cemented it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, where your allegiance lies as an audience member is kind of constantly in flux. Because before you start to sympathize with Grace, she is extremely spooky when she's being glimpsed from afar and it's just the back of her head or just her silhouette or what have you. These directors have a very good eye for, like I was saying earlier, just glimpses of something that you kind of don't want to confront head on.
Yeah.
But we do see her face. I referred to it as a grand reveal earlier. It's nothing that ostentatious. She's just sitting in a passenger seat of a car en route to the lodge where they're going around Christmas time. And she just turns around and says hello. And she looks a little bedraggled and a little wan, maybe.
Maybe just a touch spacey.
Yeah, but basically benign.
Yeah. So they head up to the lodge and Richard stays for the night. They have dinner together and whatnot. Again, it's a very tense dinner, very tense situation. And then the next morning he leaves because he basically has to work up until Christmas Day, more or less. So he leaves, and that's when we get really into the meat of this movie, where it's just Grace and Aiden and Mia alone together in the house.
We take a deep dive into Grace's subjective experience at this point. Her point of view really hijacks the movie. We know that she's got some lingering trauma, obviously, to do with her childhood. And we know that she had what I first took to be a pill habit of some kind that she was keeping from Richard. She at one point hides a pill bottle behind her back when they're having a conversation.
I'm pretty sure they're just antipsychotics.
I think that whatever they are, she needs them, right, as we soon learn. She also has nosebleeds periodically, and she is very put off by all of the crosses and paintings of saints and other Christian doodads hung up around the lodge, none of which have come down out of reverence for Alicia Silverstone's memory.
Yeah.
Before he leaves, he shows her a family heirloom in the form of a handgun, takes her out back, is going to show her how to use it.
And then she just fires off 5 or 6 rounds.
Bang on target every time. She's like shooting a tree stump. And so she's very adept. You get the sense that her dad was like a doomsday prepper or something, that she must have been raised with some proficiency in firearms.
Yeah.
And he's kind of taken aback by that. Not, you know, just impressed. He's not, like, alarmed. He's, sure, you know, glad that she'll be able to defend herself in his absence.
Right.
Stuff starts going missing around the lodge, first a little bit and then all at once. It starts with the girl's doll, which turns up in Grace's suitcase under her bed. So we're automatically thinking, all right, she's pilfering stuff. Maybe she's sleepwalking. She helps Mia find the doll.
Quote unquote.
Pins it on the dog. Like, oh, he must have thought it was a toy. The daughter doesn't buy it. And then,
just to be clear, this is Grace's dog as opposed to the family dog. So
yes, the dog's name is Grady, I think, which can only be a Shining reference.
You gotta be. Remote snowbound location.
Yeah, what have you. They also watched The Thing around this time, the John Carpenter one, in case the remote snowbound atmosphere wasn't oppressive enough for you already. I'm surprised they didn't do a The Thing Hateful Eight double feature.
Eventually The Thing gets to be too much for Grace, and she asks if they want to watch something else, so they end up watching, what is that movie called, Jack Frost?
I think it's, so there, yes, I believe it is just called Jack Frost. It's the one where Michael Keaton turns into a snowman. And it's funny that she uses that movie as a palate cleanser, because the snowman design in that movie is scarier than any nightmare that Rob Bottin has ever had. Or Bottin, I don't know, I've heard both.
I think it's Bottin, yeah.
She wakes up, I believe the next morning. There's a lot of, speaking of nightmares, there's a lot of dream imagery kind of suffusing the movie at this point. But she wakes up, I believe, the following morning.
Yeah, there's a lot of dream imagery and you lose sense of time real quick.
Mm-hmm. Sharing, I'm sure, her disorientation. Her disorientation is compounded the following morning by the fact that her pills go missing. And so do a lot of her clothes. And the food is out of the fridge. And the power is out. And they can't get the heat on. And the pipes are all frozen.
And the kids' stuff is mostly gone, too.
And no one takes responsibility for this. She blames the kids. The kids blame her. And that leaves them more or less with a stalemate.
Right.
And so now we're thinking, like, okay, is this like a home invasion, The Strangers situation, where they're being menaced by some outside party that we have hitherto not seen? Or is she cracking up? Probably the most plausible explanation, right, at this point in the proceedings. Or are the kids up to no good?
Yeah. Honestly, I didn't even really entertain the idea that it was a third party. I figured it had to be her or the kids. Her sleepwalking and subconsciously trying to kill everybody, or the kids pulling some shenanigans.
Yeah, the only reason my mind drifted to, well, it's two reasons, actually. The only reason my mind drifted to Manson family creepery as a possible culprit is, A, her cult background. I thought maybe this is going to go in like a Marcy, Martha, May, Marlene direction, where she's being antagonized by some vestigial element of the cult. But also, I just thought, if this is just a another case of like, is it the crazy mom or is it the crazy kids? Then it is just Goodnight Mommy again in different attire. And I thought maybe they would throw a curveball at us to get out of that dichotomy.
Right.
Turns out they don't, although I still mostly like the way things shake out. And the way things shake out after a lot of kind of haunted house bump in the night stuff where, you know, like the word repent shows up on her bathroom mirror at some point. You can see it under the steamed up glass fingerprints that spell out repent.
There's a rather alarming scene. This is a bit earlier on, really, but it's all of a piece where she's like aggressively playing an organ or something.
A deafeningly loud organ.
That's really the second quiet, quiet bang.
Yes.
Moment in this movie.
The dog goes missing.
Mm-hmm.
The dog is nowhere to be found. She looks out the window at one point and just sees dozens of snow angels.
Yeah.
So they're all going hungry at this point. They're all shivering. The lodge is just getting incrementally colder and more dismal looking.
Yeah.
And night is pitch black without any power. So there is a lot of just bumping around in the dark, waiting for things to jump out at you. And you don't even know what you're afraid of most of the time. Like, you don't know what's going to jump out of the dark, but it's very, very tense. Anyway, the way all of this shakes out, after Grace resolves to walk to the nearest town, sets out on foot with just a blanket wrapped around her shoulders, and then sometime later finds herself back at the lodge, having gone in a circle. The kid confronts her, meaning
Aiden.
Book of Henry, and he posits that maybe all of them are deceased. Because one thing that has turned up out of everything that went, she finds some items buried in a snowbank on the front porch, some stuff that had gone missing and some stuff that she had never seen before, including a picture of the two kids with an epigraph that says, "In loving memory."
Right. And he also tells her in the course of this, like, oh, I had a dream last night after we were watching the movie and turned on this gas heater to supplement the fire and whatever other heat the house was supposed to be producing. I had this dream that it malfunctioned and started smoking and we all suffocated.
Yes.
And so in his theory that he's offering, that wasn't a dream. That was the end of their lives.
And now they're all haunting the lodge, and that's why time is getting fucky and they can't find any of their things, I guess, because the lodge has been cleaned out.
Yeah.
And they're just stuck stumbling around in the dark in this frozen hell, basically. I mean, it really is just like a descent into hell and insanity. She's in a very fragile state psychologically.
Yeah, and when she leaves to try and make it into town or find help or whatever, she comes across this very bizarre looking other cabin. It's like shaped like a cross.
Yes, it is.
It's stubby on the bottom, and then it's got like a middle floor that juts out on either side, and it's got another one on top that's the same as the one on the first floor. And it looks like there's somebody in there. Maybe it's her dad. It's kind of unclear.
Yeah, she's being plagued by her dad's voice all through the movie.
And also by visions of her dad.
Yeah, he keeps telling her to repent.
At one point, she dreams that she falls through the ice, and he's dragging her down because this follows her actually falling through the ice earlier on when Richard is still around.
Yeah, best thing about that scene is that she falls into the ice as she's attempting to retrieve this doll from the funeral scene that recurs throughout the movie. And when Richard fishes her out of the ice, the daughter scampers over and grabs goes for the doll first.
Right.
Like, this inanimate thing that represents her mother is more important than Grace, who is still alive and who is floundering in ice cold water. It's kind of an early indication that the kids are not all right and we might have a bad seed situation on our hands.
Yeah. As it turns out, once Aiden and Mia can see that Grace has snapped or is damn close, they realize they have gone too far, and it is revealed officially to us, the audience, that they have been gaslighting her this entire time.
Right. And there's reason to believe that they didn't kill the dog. The daughter tearfully confesses that she accidentally left the door open. I'm inclined to believe that.
Yeah, they're shitty kids, but it's not a full-on bad seed thing.
Right.
They're not murderous children.
I mean, the kid is a little sociopath. We see at one point a little intercom or a radio or something that he's been using to broadcast excerpts from the death tape from his dad's laptop, which is why she's been hearing the dad's voice, I thought.
I think you're absolutely right. That just didn't register to me at all because...
The dad's voice is so ubiquitous.
The dad's voice is so ubiquitous, yeah. And there's a shot of a speaker... But I just, like, that didn't even register because there's a long stretch in this movie where it's like, is it a dream? Is it really happening? Are they alive? Are they dead?
Is she crazy? Are they crazy? Is everyone crazy?
So, yeah, it didn't even really stick out to me that way. But, yeah, that's most likely what that was. He's been amping up his gaslighting with some mind fuckery of a different variety.
Yeah, some good old-fashioned theatrics. I mean, this is, a proper gaslight narrative in the, like, Ingrid Bergman sense. It's someone making a concerted effort to drive someone insane.
Yes.
And it works. She has well and truly cracked at this point. There's a very alarming shot of her outside in the snow, on her knees, trudging in a circle that she's worn into the snow, that she's just gone around and around and around.
And she's trying to repent.
Spends a lot of time kneeling in the back half of this movie, actually. She also kneels on a bunch of burning logs in order to atone for breaking up this marriage and, in a sense, costing this woman's life.
And then also their lives in general, because, I don't know, she allowed the gas heater to be running that she killed them.
Right.
Yeah, so at this point, Aiden and Mia really know that they done goofed. they're
Yeah, time to pack it in.
Yeah, they're trying to walk it back, and they can't. There's a scene where, not for the first time, Grace is flashing back to her walk through the basement of the cult compound doing her video recording and seeing all the shrouded bodies. And she comes to one and stops, and then it cuts to daytime in the lodge. She's standing over Aiden. I'm getting kind of chills just describing it, actually.
Yes.
It's freaky. And
with this massively disaffected look on her face.
Completely catatonic.
Yes.
And he's trying to wake her up, and she's holding the gun also to her side.
Yes.
And Mia's trying to wake her up, and they're shaking her. She throws Mia off, gives Mia like a cut over her eye.
The gun is basically never out of her hand from this point onward.
Yeah.
And, mercifully, there's not that much movie left, because the movie that is left is just unbearably suspenseful, I thought.
Yeah.
Richard makes a Dick Halloran journey back up to the cabin. Yeah. Like Scatman Crothers in The Shining, he shows up just as the shit is hitting the fan, comes a long way basically to be done in almost immediately.
Yeah. So the kids, after they have this run-in in the bedroom with a catatonic Grace, who comes to her senses but doesn't really seem all that affected. Like, I was expecting her to come out of her fugue state and then be like, oh, Jesus. But apparently she's past that. Mm-hmm. She's just slightly less catatonic after she comes out of it. And after that, they decamp to the attic. And they're just sleeping up there to the point where Mia says, you know, I have to pee. And Aiden just says, pee in the corner. We can't go downstairs right now.
Right, because they've been hearing screams come up through the floorboards as she's self-flagellating through all manner of means, torturing herself. And the next time we see her, her face is... It's not like she, like, carved her face off Mason Verger style, but she's obviously been, like, brutalizing herself all night.
And they do, also, before they go upstairs for good, they see her kneeling on the burning logs.
Yeah.
From behind, but still. Mia insists that she has to go pee, and she's not going to pee in the corner. And after she tries to pee, and this was another really spooky fucking shot.
Oh, yes.
Where Mia hears something, and she's walking down the hall, and there's just like a pitch black space at the other end of the hallway, and we just see the barest glimpse of Grace starting to emerge from the shadows.
Yeah, just her face, almost disembodied.
Yeah, and again, we even barely see that. It's almost not there.
Yeah, which is, as I keep saying, what these directors love to do, just afford you a quick glimpse of something and then take it away. In this case, you actually want to see more just because you want a spatial awareness, in like a survivalist kind of way. You want a spatial awareness of where the danger is going to come from, and they deny you that.
Yeah.
It makes it exponentially scarier.
So Mia runs back upstairs and runs into her brother's arms, but Grace sort of Terminator style slowly, inexorably follows her upstairs.
Yeah, plods up the staircase.
And walks over to them and is very much like, we have to atone. We have to atone for our sins, which echoes back to a scene earlier on. This is right after Aiden drops the we're all dead theory, when he and Mia are like fervently attempting to pray, and this is before Grace goes catatonic and she just starts screaming at Aiden to stop and shut the fuck up. And so now the
shoe's on the other foot,
the rubber band is on the other claw. And yeah, so she's bringing the gun up, and it's at this time that they hear like the crunch of tires on snow and like a car horn, because Richard has arrived.
Grace also attempts to burn the doll, and Mia is
it's like not it's like she it. Lit her actual mother on fire.
Right, exactly. Like she, the same way that she fished her out of the pond and gave her priority then. It is, yeah, it's exactly like it's her mother's flesh and blood.
So Richard walks in and he keeps calling for Grace, and then he sees like the still frozen corpse of the dog having been placed back in the dog bed.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the entryway, and he's like, eh, something's wrong.
I kept thinking, like, as he walked in, what is he gonna see that's gonna tip him off? Like, what would be the spookiest? Is he gonna see the burning logs? Is he gonna like notice that the fridge is empty? There's a lot of potential red flags.
I mean, he probably, they don't make a big deal out of this, but it probably, at least if I were him, would have occurred to him that there are no Christmas decorations up, despite the fact that Grace left him a voicemail saying that they put up Christmas decorations.
Yeah.
So that, he probably would have been like, well, where are they? That's weird. But then, yeah.
In any
case, he sees the dead dog.
Seeing the dog is like the creepiest, and especially like the way it's posed in this kind of frozen taxidermy stare. It was exactly the right call.
Yeah. And so he calls for Grace one more time, and then he starts calling for his kids.
Yes.
And gets upstairs, and yeah, he's like on the landing halfway up the stairs, and Grace is walking down holding the gun, and the kids are kind of inching up behind her, and she's saying how I need to repent, etc., etc., and she brings the gun up to her head, and he's like, no. We're not all dead. Give me the gun. She pulls the trigger, and we think that she's going to die, but then it just, there's like a misfire, or the chamber she was on was empty.
It could have been a Russian roulette situation.
Yeah, just clicks. And then she takes aim at him instead. I have to do this. We have to repent. Sure enough, he ends up getting shot in the face, and the kids run off.
Yeah, they do what everyone in the audience is hoping that they'll do, which is go straight for the car and book it.
Unfortunately, they get caught in some snow while they're trying to like pull a K-turn backing out.
And to be fair, when this is one of the most like topsy-turvy moments in the movie, when the dad leaves, it does look like he does a big curve in reverse, like all the way around the house. It goes on for like 25 seconds of him just backing up in this big,
like, loop-y-loop. Okay, bye. Okay, yeah. Bye now, bye.
It's like you have to reverse all the way off the property. It's
down
very
the
odd.
Mountain. Yeah.
Yeah. But everything in this movie has that element of like perversity to it. I'm gonna talk about that more after the break.
Yeah.
Just a kind of fundamental wrongness.
Suffice to say, the kids do not end up getting away because they've well and truly,
they can't execute that incredible maneuver the way their pa could.
Yeah. So the next scene, we have Grace sitting across from the children at the dining table with Richard's corpse at the head of the table.
Yeah, right where it belongs, just like the dog's corpse in its bed.
Yeah.
Everything's in its right place.
And they have soup or beans or something in a bowl in front of them, and nobody's really eating or moving. And then she just starts singing Nearer My God to Thee, mm-hmm. which is not the first time we've heard this song. Seems like the cult theme song almost.
Yeah, it came up at the funeral too, if I'm not mistaken.
And near the end of the song, the kids kind of half-heartedly join in. And then she stands up, Grace does, and walks over behind them. And puts duct tape over each of their mouths, and over the duct tape is written the word sin. This is, again, iconography from the dead cultists. They all had similarly labeled tape on their mouths. She puts it over her mouth, and cut to black.
Yep, it's just a pitch black denouement. It really, really goes for broke.
So we're going to go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with our thoughts afterwards.
What is that?
It's Christ.
Everyone committed suicide except for her.
Repent, and you will find salvation.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
It's okay. Trust me. You have nothing to be scared about.
And we're back. So, Matt, take it away.
This is the movie that Book of Henry should have been.
You dickhead.
They are both about sociopathic pubescent master criminals who concoct an elaborate scheme that comes to ruin in a All right. I mean, I never miss a trick when it comes to
dunking on Colin
Trevorrow. Dunking on C. Trev. Yeah, but no, I mean, it's what's the kid's name from It? Bill?
Jaden Martell.
Yeah, he's very proficient at playing this kind of character, this sort of ice-cold little master manipulator. All the performances are good. I mean, we always sing the praises of the actors whose work we devour in all but the schlockiest of schlock.
It's true.
And this movie is not schlock. It's very kind of highfalutin. The actress who plays Grace is very good. She's got sort of a little bit of like an Elizabeth Moss affect sometimes with a smile or.
Okay.
And then sometimes like a little bit of a K-Stew thing going on when she's tripping over her words or mumbling. But when all is said and done, she's like a singular presence. And I feel like this isn't Carrie and her mom. This isn't just any run-of-the-mill kind of religious wackadoo that I've seen in a bunch of other horror movies. This is a new entity that I'm dealing with here. Her character reminded me a little bit of the protagonist of Elle, the Verhoeven movie. In that she's the survivor of like a massacre of some kind, childhood survivor. But it really is her transformation is just something to behold. It's really spooky stuff. I mean, Jim said before the break that he was getting chills just recounting some of the beats that this story hits. And I feel physically chilly still just talking about it. This is a very like snowbound, wintry kind of movie. It's a good movie to watch in a cold theater. Actually, one where the AC is cranked up just a little bit too high. I was very taken with it. I liked it more than Book of Henry. Probably goes without saying.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. That tracks.
I said right off the bat, you know, I brought up this idea that, oh, you've seen one Cabin Fever movie. You've kind of seen them all. This is something I've been harping on kind of a lot lately. We got it with The Lighthouse, a whole bunch of stuff. It's a bottomless well for horror movies to keep drawing from, just people cooped up somewhere
going crazy together.
Yeah.
And you also happen to be partial to those sorts of movies.
Very much so.
Assuming they're not terrible.
Yeah. And this movie lampshades that to an extent. Okay, so there's two things that I really like about the scene where they're watching The Thing. One is that the scene that they're watching, at least initially, is the one guy getting patched up after the helicopter attack near the beginning of the movie. He's talking about like, why would they shoot at a dog like that? And the doctor says, cabin fever, who knows? And it's such a pat, like, you know, yeah, that's
yep,
there's the movie. He's just, the incuriosity of that line is really ahead of its time. I think Thing only came out like 2 years after The Shining, where Ullman talks at length about cabin fever in a much drier kind of ponderous sort of way. So just to have that line trotted out was pretty amusing. The other thing that I like about that scene is that when they break out the defibrillators, anyone who's seen The Thing will know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, clear!
Chomp.
When the jaws snap shut on his wrists, there's a crash in the lodge. A painting has fallen off the wall, and that was... Movies within movies can produce this effect sometimes where it feels like the horror, not in a literal Samara in the Ring kind of way, but like something has jumped off the screen at you. You know,
well,
there's
right,
kind of like there's a Russian doll thing going on.
Yeah.
Where one layer of fiction has escaped into the next most layer, and then if you follow that to its logical conclusion, Grace could walk off the screen and harm you in some way. That's
right.
That's the implication.
Or just, it's as simple as you feel like you're watching The Thing, and it's as though something has fallen off the wall in your own home.
Right. Yeah,
at exactly. The same time.
It reminded me of the climax of Fall of the House of Usher, where the story that the guy is reading is being echoed in strange ways by the sister emerging from her crypt, the clanging doors and the hinges and what have you.
Right.
Very good stuff. I said before the break that there's this kind of pervasive atmosphere of perversity through the whole movie. There's just this omnipresent eeriness. I know that the animatronic Santa Claus got a rise out of you just because it's everything in this movie is just way spookier than it has any right to be, to the point where the movie risks veering into self-parody. If the tone of it wasn't so oppressive and so formidable, it would be easy to sniff at. Because every damn thing is just odd looking or creepy or just not quite right, just a little bit askew.
Well, yeah, the animatronic Santa in question is not like one of those that has a saxophone and does a dance. It's an animatronic Santa that moves so little that you wonder what the point is of it moving at all. And it just crosses
and uncrosses its hands in a very sinister way.
Yeah, it's like, why does it do that? Why can't it just like make music and light up? Why does it have to move like that? So yeah.
And the movie is replete with little odds and ends like that, too many to list, so I won't bother. But the cumulative effect is pretty powerful, I think. This movie really wore me down and just chilled me to my core.
The other thing just kind of compositionally about this movie that kind of gets to you after a while is that it's like the antithesis of Wes Anderson. You know, Wes Anderson, everything is perpendicular. Everything is at right angles to a fault. And this is, all the compositions in this movie are aggressively on a diagonal.
Yeah, that's true.
To the point where, I don't know, you always feel off kilter. It's always like a little bit askew.
But not in like a carnival funhouse way where you're like, stop the ride, I want to get off. It's more like being a little bit seasick
right.
All the time, which reminded me of The Lighthouse.
Yes.
Yeah, no, you're 100% correct. It reminded me of several things. It kicks off with this sequence where the mother takes her own life. And that, to me, called back to Don't Look Now or Midsommar more recently,
yeah,
or The Changeling, where it just opens. These are all horror movies that open with unfathomable familial tragedy, just like an irreconcilable loss. And so the movie, the whole thrust of the movie is kind of about grief and about grieving. And this is something that Hereditary does also, although it saves it more for the midpoint.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I mean, there are times, I mean, Ari Aster does this a lot. I think I talked about this in our Midsommar review. Florence Pugh or Toni Collette, you just, in his movies and in this movie also, you see just abject sorrow.
Yeah.
You know, just
from women specifically.
Yes, yes. Just grief-stricken, wailing, gnashing of teeth, choking sobs. And you got a little bit of that in this movie with the daughter. It's a little more low-key, fewer histrionics. In particular, when Grace goes mad, she does so in a catatonic sort of way, not in a scenery-chewing, here's Johnny kind of way.
Right.
Which I liked. But yeah, I don't know. It's just there's just a coldness that as the cabin gets colder and colder, it's like the light just leaks out of the movie. Then the hope just recedes into the distance and disappears. It's just the most ominous, dreary. These are all superlatives in case that wasn't clear.
Yeah.
It's a very grim spectacle.
Yeah. To break up the love fest,
sure,
a bit.
I have beef with it too, but sure, you take the lead.
And I mean, I think it's clear we both like this movie quite well, perhaps to differing degrees, but in the aggregate, we're on board. That said, there are certain things about this movie I don't love. One of them, speaking of Hereditary, is this device the movie uses of a dollhouse.
Yes, I was going to harp about that too. The dioramas that it keeps coming to, more or less without context, it seemed to me. It keeps cutting away to these little dollhouse set pieces depicting scenes from the movie, but it's not clear. I mean, in Hereditary, that was Toni Collette's whole shtick.
That was her work.
Yeah, exactly. It was her profession. And here, it's just sort of apropos of nothing.
Yeah.
Unless I missed something.
Well, eventually, first of all, it's scenes from the movie, but they're not, it's like they're foreshadowing.
Yes.
And like we see a scene of the two kids and Grace in the living room of the cabin, like kind of sprawled out like they're dead. And we see, I don't think we mentioned this specifically, there's a scene where Aiden is doing his damnedest to convince Grace that they're all dead, and he hangs himself. Mia screams for Grace to come, and we see Aiden dangling, and then he lifts his head and starts talking, and we find out later he doesn't really explain it at length. It's like a Guy Ritchie Sherlock Holmes kind of spoilers
Some Houdini-ass thing, some kind of harness or something, where he hung himself but didn't strangulate himself. I disliked that scene for a few reasons. First and foremost, just that when he, like, him hanging there and then looking up and talking conversationally is just way too Beetlejuice.
A little bit for me.
It's like speaking of Michael Keaton and Jack Frost. Right. It's like ghoulish in a kind of low stakes, lightweight way.
Yeah.
That doesn't suit the rest of the movie at all.
But anyway, so that's another scene that we see in the dollhouse. And what comes out in the climax of the film is Richard is like looking inside this dollhouse back at home and like sees all this stuff. And I don't know, you almost get the sense the movie wants you to think that he's figured out the kid's scheme.
Or that he orchestrated it. That's what I thought, is he in on it? Did he deliberately leave Grace alone with the kids and, like, instruct them to gaslight her?
I wondered about that before the scene where he discovers the dollhouse, but when he sees the dollhouse, he kind of...
See, I thought he was working on the dollhouse, so that was my error,
no,
I think.
I got the impression that he was supposed to look alarmed.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of why he's... like hurries to the car.
That's perfect. That's his Book of Henry moment. That's like him finding the fucking audio tapes, like realizing what his insane son has been scheming about these many weeks.
But at the same time, if that was the case that he figured out what was going on, I would have expected him when he got to the lodge to come like sprinting out of the car instead of cautiously walking inside like, hey, Grace, you here? You here? And, like, thinking it was a little weird, but not really freaking out till he finds the dog. So, I don't know. That's kind of, it's kind of a little ambiguous and not in a good way.
Yeah,
but
all of the diorama stuff is just too derivative of Hereditary.
Right.
For
yeah,
my
that's,
liking.
Exactly.
The movie would be better off without
it's
it.
It's just Hereditary light, and, yeah, we could have done without it entirely.
I will say Goodnight Mommy struck me as much more of a Michael Haneke or Lars von Trier European horror kind of movie, and The Lodge is like a thoroughbred Ari Aster ripoff.
Right.
Which is not to say that it's bad. I like it rather a lot, but it is very much part of this A24 horror renaissance going on right now. It's fits right in with the rest of the pack. It's become much more westernized, I think, in terms of its influences. But it's still got those, Severin and Fiala, are those their names? It's got still got those.
No. That's one guy's name. It's Severin Fiala and
Veronica Franz, yes. I think. Yeah, it's still got those Franz and Fiala touches that were present in Goodnight Mommy, where again you see glimpses of something that you don't really want to get a better look at.
Yeah, the one word I would use to describe their style is glimpses.
Yes.
It's just
especially when you get the imposter mom stuff at the beginning of this movie. I mean, that's straight out of the Goodnight Mommy playbook.
Yeah, for sure. as much as a lot of this movie's tension comes from the who's crazy, who's doing what, who's responsible for what, it does get to be a little bit more of a muddle in the middle of the movie than I want it to be.
See, all right, so anyone who's listened to our review of The Turning knows that I have a very high threshold for incoherence.
For muddle, yes.
Probably too high. If it's in service of cultivating a particular mood, I liked it in this movie for a very specific and kind of strange reason, which is that there were stretches in this movie that made me feel like there was a gas leak and that like I was a little foggy headed or that I was going through some kind of antipsychotic withdrawal. But like the gas leak thing in particular, like once Book of Henry comes right out and says, I think we're dead, I think that we all asphyxiated, I got this sinking like, oh no, kind of feeling in a way that, you know, the they were dead the whole time twist shouldn't work anymore. Since The Sixth Sense and since The Others, it's been done to death. It was old hat even then in the late 90s and early aughts. But when he said that, I just, you know, I got goosebumps. And like, and it turns out the movie isn't actually, you know, swerves left and then immediately swerves right and says, no, it was all a ruse. It was all a gaslighting routine, which I also liked. But that moment still worked for me because of the incoherence that and the muddle that preceded it. No, I didn't like the way that he just came right out and said it. I thought that that was kind of inelegant.
Which yeah.
winds up working given that he's gaslighting
it's all, her. It's all a scheme.
Yeah, right. But I thought the execution there could have still used a little bit more fine-tuning.
You see, I was more intrigued even just in concept by this, you know, they're all dead. Because even though, as you say, done to death, Sixth Sense, The Others, etc., it seemed like this movie was potentially going to dive into what would happen if, you know, three people died of a gas leak in a lodge up in the snowy mountains where nobody would find them and they started haunting it.
It's such a scary notion. It just makes me feel cold all over just thinking about it, you know, and the fact that they have an acrimonious relationship, just the idea of the dad coming back and finding them.
Right.
It really just makes my hair stand up.
So given the fact that fit into the context of the rest of this movie, that twist works so much better than it normally would, I almost wanted that to be what the movie was.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
And I don't know how that movie would have concluded. Clearly, it wouldn't have allowed for the ending that this movie ended up having, which more or less works. But I kind of wanted to see it go in that direction. And then there was a bit of a letdown when we see the scene of Mia and Aiden going down into the basement and moving some boards aside. And we see the treasure trove of all the stuff that's been emptied out of the lodge.
Yeah.
And then he caves and tries to tell Grace that they were gaslighting her the whole time.
And part of what I found so disquieting about that possibility being broached, and this thought was one of many racing through my head around this point in the movie, you know, because this is the kind of movie where you derive some pleasure from being one step ahead and trying to figure out where it's headed. So I thought, oh God, what makes this so unsettling is that the dad's going to get back to the lodge, find their asphyxiated corpses, and there'll never be closure because he'll never know if she did it on purpose.
Right.
Because of her childhood and because of what she's been through, there will always be, you know, that's how this story is going to resonate with people. This lunatic gassed the two kids in her care.
And how could he have been so stupid to leave them with her?
Right, exactly. That she was still proselytizing in a, you know, carrying on her father's legacy. You know, and that even if it was just an accident, it was just a misunderstanding, but she's going to be libeled and slandered. And it's just such a shitty way to die for her specifically. Yeah. Now, I think that the gaslighting stuff, the way that pans out, that also brings the cult thing full circle in a very different way that I also found satisfying. But upon reflection, I agree with you. Maybe not quite as satisfying.
Yeah. The other thing, and this is a lot more mechanical, and so in the final analysis, it really matters less. I didn't know exactly what she was trying to accomplish with the gun, given the fact that
she thought they were already dead.
She thought they were already dead.
I get it when she puts it to her own head, because then it's just her doing to Richard what Book of Henry did to her when he hanged himself. It's proof. She figured she would blow her brains out and then still be standing there. In fact, I think that she thinks that is what happened when she pulls the trigger and nothing happens. I think she probably heard a bang in her disordered brain. Why she shoots him, I don't know.
Well, I guess it's just supposed to be more proof, maybe. And maybe that was the idea when she comes up with the gun to confront the two kids in the attic. But in that scene, it seems she's like, okay, you have to repent, and this is how you repent, by committing suicide after you're already dead,
mm-hmm.
using this gun. And that, it's just, that was kind of a, I don't want to keep saying a muddle, but it was kind of unclear what the idea was behind that.
Yeah.
And as I said at the beginning of this tangent, in the final analysis, it doesn't really make that much of a difference, so it's less of an issue to me than whether I prefer the gaslighting or the we are actually already dead narrative.
The gaslighting or the gas.
Sure.
Goodnight Mommy does this exact same thing. There's a point about 80% of the way through both of these movies where you just snap back to reality. Oh, there goes gravity, you know, and you are suddenly looking at everything with a very clear-eyed kind of perspective. And the crazy one is visibly, unmistakably crazy. And you just have both feet on the ground and your head on straight all of a sudden. In Goodnight Mommy, there's a twist. Goodnight Mommy was undermined for me, the impact of it, to a large extent, because its twist and its central gimmick, which I guess I won't spoil, is very reminiscent of a movie from the 70s that I really like called The Other, not to be confused with The Others, which I talked about 10-ish minutes ago. I'm getting into the weeds. Point being, Goodnight Mommy and The Lodge both do this thing where there's ambiguity until there isn't. And right. all the ambiguity gets just sucked out of the movie in like one fell swoop at almost the exact same moment in the runtime, it felt like. And there's something, I like both of these movies. I like The Lodge more than Goodnight Mommy, but I don't want to see them do this exact thing again. I don't want to have another is the mom crazy or is it a bad seed dichotomy set up. I don't want the rug pulling that happens in the last act to impose sanity upon upon the mise-en-scene the way that it does here. They're very talented filmmakers. I just think they cannot continue to beat this dead horse.
No.
On the subject of horror movie mechanics, I share your consternation with the cacophonous organ. There is a few scare chords in this movie that basically have no rhyme or reason. They just kind of wham, gotcha, and it's a cheap trick. And I think this movie's better than that. It did rattle my bones, effectively, but it's...
Well, you know, it's hard to compete with a deafening minor key organ.
That is not prepared for in any way.
Right.
It's a very abrupt cut, and then all of a sudden, brr, and there you are. And you either jumped or you haven't. Your heart lurches, and then it's over. It's an instant... It's like a cattle prod feeling. And I just feel like that has kind of... This movie is so much artier than that. And I think that they're pulling out all the stops to try and scare you. And I respect that. But that's another dead horse that I don't want to see them keep beating. The other thing, I said before the break during the plot rundown that the death cult footage that they find on the laptop is a little sub-VHS for my liking. The imagery is spooky, but it just turns into such a found footage movie for a second. That I wish it had just been like news crews,
yeah,
going through or something, or crime scene photographs. Just because it's the way it's filmed,
I would
felt
even,
like schlockier than anything else in the movie.
And I would even go further back than VHS. Honestly, I got Blair Witch out of it.
Yeah,
like it her walking around because most of at least the first half of the found footage segment, she's like pointing the camera more or less to the ground, which is infamously a Blair Witch thing.
Yes.
And the basement that she's in is kind of strewn with detritus, and it's just like the ending of Blair Witch, that cabin, whatever the hell,
mm-hmm.
in the forest. And so, yeah, in that sense, it's even more old hat than just sub-VHS.
Yeah, I mean, as far as found footage goes, that's about as old hat as it gets.
Yeah, exactly.
Not quite, but nearly. And yeah, no, I think that I wish that had been implemented a little differently. But other than that, this movie is rock solid. It really, really got under my skin. We've been on a hot streak lately with these A24 wannabes. It's a good time to be a horror junkie, at least if you're a horror junkie like me with my proclivities.
Sure.
I tend to go in for the kind of highbrow stuff, the kind of stuff that will put The Thing on in the background and name a dog Grady. <You know? laughs> It respects its elders.
Respect!
Respect! Yeah. Speaking of neon.
Yeah. All right, well, with that, this has been another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandaisi.
And we will see you next time.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from The Lodge Official Trailer 2019 Wiley Keough Horror Movie HD, uploaded by One Media. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, March 15th, and we'll be discussing the haunted doll sequel, Brahms, The Boy 2. See you then.